Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup this week, the General Assembly passes a new congressional map in an effort to pick up another seat for Republicans in the midterms. Congresswoman Alma Adams says it's a political gerrymander with racial overtones.
And that's just not right.
Charlotte City Council delays a decision on naming transit board members until after the transit referendum results are known. Meanwhile, ridership on the Blue Line falls in the aftermath of the murder of Irina Zarudzka. Will he or won't he? Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden is undecided about running for re-election. Union County teachers are upset about anticipated raises not coming through. One teacher makes this prediction.
They're going to lose a lot of teachers this year.
A former Hornets player is swept up in an FBI probe into criminal sports gambling. The Panthers are on a winning streak, and Charlotte FC is playoff bound. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And a good old Hunter Sines is back with us after his globetrotting adventures. He's from WSOC-TV. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. And let me begin with something we weren't planning to talk about, but because it didn't happen until late yesterday afternoon. But boy, it's an indication of exactly where we are with people having the perception that Charlotte is not a safe city. Yesterday afternoon, two people died. The victim was also shot and killed by police in traffic at Moorhead and Freedom Drive. Hunter Sines, you reported on this. What led to all of this?
So, Mike, I'll take you in chronological order because it was a bit chaotic when we got out to the scene. It's two different scenes. This all started just after 4 o'clock yesterday when police say a man shot two people near the Brookshire and Hoskins. There's a neighborhood behind a QT. We first thought it happened at the QT. It looks like it actually happened in the neighborhood streets. But police say that a suspect shot two people. One of them died. Another was rushed to the hospital and at last check was in critical condition. The suspect then ran off into that neighborhood and did a home invasion, is what police say. Kidnapped a woman, got into a stolen car, and then went off. Thankfully, a 911 call was made from that kidnapping that was able to give police a description of the car. They got a hit on it, likely from a license plate reader at one of their real crime center cameras at some of the intersections. They get a hit. Police are on the suspect almost in just a few minutes. They go 77. There's a short pursuit around town. It ends on Freedom, where he U-turns and he comes down Freedom heading to Moorhead. And that's where police say he ran into the back of another vehicle that then stopped the pursuit. All the while, police say, between the two scenes, he is shooting out of the car towards police officers. He actually hit a few of their patrol units. No officers were hurt in any of this or hit by gunfire. But when he wrecks into that car at Freedom and Moorhead, police say the suspect gets out and runs. The victim that was kidnapped gets out and runs the other way and is found safe later on. Meanwhile, the suspect is still pointing the gun and shooting at officers. And you can hear it in some witness video that we have gotten sent to us. And then all of a sudden, officers, of course, open fire and kill him in the middle of Moorhead. We are still trying to figure out if that kidnapping victim, if that was a random home invasion, or if the suspect knew that home or the people in it or this woman, that is still unclear. Police were interviewing her last night at headquarters as the FBI now investigates all of this.
Eli.
Yeah, I happened to be driving on 77 near Uptown during this time and was caught in the traffic. There were police cruisers, lots of them flying down the express lanes and the shoulders from multiple directions. There's a helicopter circling overhead. And I think it's worth pointing out this was right outside Uptown in the middle of rush hour on a weekday. So this is the kind of thing that is fueling the perception that there is a lot of crime. And, you know, I think if you look at the statistics, yeah, we're still below the murders total for this time last year. We do seem to be accelerating. It seems like we're headed for a pretty violent back half of the year here. But statistics don't tell the whole story. I mean, to be totally frank, if someone kills someone inside a house in the middle of the night in the burbs, I mean, that's a tragedy. It's terrible, but it does not fuel the same perception of public disorder that high-profile crimes like this fuel. And keep in mind, it's, you know, there have been a lot of shootings and killings in and around Uptown lately. So that is in front of thousands and thousands of people.
When you have a car chase and the perpetrator is shooting at police cars in traffic as cars are moving, and then you have him jumping out of a car at a major intersection, which is right across from Pinky's restaurant and up from the Open Kitchen and down from WBTV and that near the intersection with I-77, that's a big intersection right there where he is shot and killed. And I'm told, Hunter, I think you reported that his body was in the street for quite a while because that's how it works with the crime scenes. That is remarkably brazen and remarkably dangerous.
It is a blessing, Mike, that we have not heard of or know of anybody else that was hit by gunfire when he is shooting at police in between these two scenes during a pursuit nearly in the middle of rush hour. Those bullets land somewhere, right? And I think, you know, police did say that they are trying to canvas that in between to see where those bullets hit businesses, cars, who knows. But there were no other victims that came forward from being hit. But you bring up a good point, too, that I want to emphasize is you have to imagine for a minute, police are getting shot at. They're in a busy intersection on Moorhead where we know it gets backed up with traffic every day around that time. And just imagining there had to have been cars, businesses, there's restaurants, as they then have to make that decision to open fire on a suspect that is clearly a threat with a kidnapping victim and shooting at police already.
Hmm. Do we know anything more about the perpetrator?
We have not gotten an identification yet on the suspect. Of course, once we do, that would open the floodgates into his past, where he lived. We're also trying to figure out more information regarding the victims at that first scene and how and why this all started there.
You were also caught in the traffic because of this, Mary, I know. Just from a person's perspective, caught in this, did you know what was going on, or was it just one of those days when I'm stuck in traffic?
Initially, I did. Yeah. So I had just a few minutes after five made the left from Wilkinson Boulevard onto Moorhead, and usually takes me maybe 2 minutes to get from that turn to the intersection of Moorhead and Freedom, but got caught in a line of traffic right around WBTV station and Legion Brewing. Initially thought it was just rush hour, but then saw there were a number of police cars up ahead, and obviously that put my antenna up. And pretty soon after was told very sternly but politely from a uniformed CMPD officer that we all needed to make a U-turn and weren't going to be allowed down Moorhead. So that obviously, you know, sent me to reaching out to my Observer colleagues and our friends at our fellow news outlets to see what was going on. So yeah, it was pretty evident from the volume of police officers and fire trucks and medic vehicles that were around that there was something going on beyond the usual, you know, evening traffic or even a fender bender that can back things up that time of day.
Of course, something like this can happen anywhere at any time, and that's part of the reason people are so frightened by this activity. And I don't know what the solution is, but we'll find out more about this incident as the day and the week end goes on. I'm sure our newsrooms, our collective newsrooms, are working on this right now. North Carolina's Republican lawmakers gave final approval this week to a new congressional map intended to pick up another seat for their party. What had been a 7-7 Republican-Democrat map became a 10-4 map favoring Republicans just 2 years ago, and now it will be 11-3. At least that's the way it is designed. Will it necessarily work out that way, Eli, or could voters see this for what it is and reject Republican candidates?
Well, it's always up to the voters, of course, but what they've done is...
For the moment.
For now, is essentially they have shuffled... several hundred thousand voters in the northeast corner of the state from one district to another. And what they've done really is instead of having a 60% Republican district and a 50-50 swing district, now there's two more or less 55% Republican districts. So The one swing district, which is District 1, is now a lean Republican district. So statistically, it's going to be very difficult for a Democrat to break that and is most likely to give us an 11-3 map.
So they accomplished this out of sync gerrymander by redrawing District 1, which has historically had a higher percentage of black voters than any other precinct or district in the state. The district is right now 40.42% black. That would drop to 32.34%. So remind us, first of all, why it was drawn this way in the first place. Why was it drawn to favor black voters and black candidates?
Well, it's worth remembering that North Carolina has had 7 maps in the last 9 years, so they have been redrawn for a number of reasons. When we go back a couple maps ago to the 7-7 maps, those were created to be more even. They were created under court direction. The current maps were created to preserve some black voter centers of power, which is required under federal law, but you know, there's a Supreme Court case about that right now, actually, in another state. And the 11-3 map, what's interesting about the map that they just passed is that the Republicans have been really, really explicit, saying over and over again that this is to give themselves a Republican seat. They keep saying that. They say this is for a Republican. They're right out there saying this is for partisan reasons. It seems to me that they're trying to get ahead of the expected lawsuit that will accuse this of being a racial gerrymander. And when that hits court, they'll point back and say, no, no, it's not about race. We said over and over again, it's about partisanship. We're just trying to gain another seat for the Republican Party.
We'll talk about that. The move by Republicans obviously had fierce objections from Democrats, and Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams denounced what she views as a move to disenfranchise black voters.
So you're not just targeting a Democratic member, that's obvious, and he is black, you must know that. You're trying to dismantle the district with the largest record of black congressional leadership in North Carolina history. And that's just not right.
Speaking on the House floor, Representative Brian Cone called it out for being something else.
This is a reaction at the behest of the President of the United States and Governor Greg Abbott of Texas.
So is this more about black disenfranchisement and putting another Republican in that seat, or about our state following in the footsteps of Texas, where at the behest of Donald Trump, they redistricted their state to give him a win in the midterms? Which is it really about?
I mean, race and party affiliation have historically been so linked that you can't totally disentangle them when you're talking about gerrymandering and splitting up districts. I don't think this mid-cycle gerrymander would have happened if Texas hadn't kicked it off and then been followed by California and then Missouri. So I don't think it would have happened in the absence of other states doing it.
But as so often happens in North Carolina, because politics and race are, it seems, inextricably intertwined, and what's happened here is the disenfranchisement of black voters and the removal, unless he decides to actually physically move to a different address, of the current congressman.
But you don't have to live in your district.
You don't. That's right.
You don't? It's unpopular with voters, but you don't have to live in your congressional district.
But this seems to be a perfect intersection of that. Would it be easy to say that it's a racial gerrymander, which is not constitutional and not legal for the moment, because the Supreme Court's considering all of this right now?
Yeah, that's what Reverend Dr. Barber and other advocates are clearly going to do when they file a lawsuit. They're going to say this is racially motivated. However, I think that you've seen the Republicans lay the groundwork to push back against that and say, nope, it's not race, it's partisanship. That's all we want.
I'm going to take a break, a little more to talk about with regard to this gerrymander, and we'll talk about the No Kings protest from last weekend and the transit referendum and where that seems to stand at the moment, because early voting is underway. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo, our senior editor at WFAE News, is with us, along with Mary Ramsey, a local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Hunter Sines, reporter for WSOC-TV. A little more to talk about with regard to the gerrymandering situation in North Carolina and elsewhere. Brazen is the word of today. We began with the brazen shootout near Uptown Charlotte yesterday, and now this brazen redistricting. Republicans facing the reality of the tradition of voters generally voting against the party in the White House in the midterms are also awakening to the reality of an increasingly unpopular president, and they've done nothing to hide these gerrymandering moves around the country as anything other than a way to stay in power in Washington. But Republican House Majority Leader Brendan Jones from Columbus County put the blame on liberal Democrats.
You can be mad about redistricting all you want to, but you need to look in the mirror and ask yourself what got us here. And I think then you'll begin to realize just how bad the left messed up.
So Jones is referring in that to the fact that California Governor Gavin Newsom asked for and received legislative approval to have a referendum put on the November ballot so that voters could decide whether or not they want to gerrymander California to add more Democratic seats in response to Texas. It happened yesterday in Virginia. They're going to the Senate's going to come back into session to redistrict Virginia to add, I think, four more Democratic seats to their delegation. So how is this the Democrats' fault when it all started with Donald Trump and Greg Abbott in Texas?
Well, you know, Republicans will point to previous Democratic gerrymanders, some of which, to be fair, in other states have been egregious over the years. And I think probably the most accurate way to put it is this is a long-standing problem, a decades-long problem that has become much worse this summer as redistricting fever spreads, starting with the president's actions and Texas's actions. So this is not a new issue, and it would be false to say that either side is blameless here. But the current round that has really, I think, gone farther and faster than any we've seen before started this summer with the president and Republicans in Texas.
So let me give you the full quote from Republican Brendan Jones. He went on to say, quote, "We're here today because California and the radical left launched a full-fledged coordinated attack not only on North Carolina, but the integrity of democracy itself. Pot meet kettle. Could it be argued that the real attack on democracy is the very fact of gerrymandering?"
Yes. Okay. I think it could. And honestly, I don't know where this ends up. Tom Tillis was asked about this week in Washington, and he said, you know, Republicans in North Carolina should be careful because if Democrats win it back, then what would stop them from doing this? So, I mean, we're in this spiral, and I don't know where it ends up. Is this just something that happens every 2 years now? It was bad enough when it was happening every, you know, couple years under a court order now. But is this going to happen every time the North Carolina General Assembly comes back in session? It seems like we might be in an eternal gerrymandering cycle.
Both House and Senate leaders are now saying that this redistricting decision will likely be their final vote of 2025. That would mean no movement on the budget and no action on Medicaid funding. What will be the impact of that?
Well, the Governor Stein has said that the Medicaid program in the state will face cuts. People, providers will face reduced payments. People might lose coverage, and providers might cut jobs as well. So that is one issue. Another is until there's a permanent budget, there's no raises for teachers and other state workers beyond the smaller cost of living increases that were approved in a mini budget. So those are the two biggest things hanging out there right now: Medicaid and teacher and state employee pay. And it looks like those are not going to be resolved anytime soon. I'm not a historian, but this would be one of the longest stretches we've ever gone without a full budget in the state.
7 million people marched around the country last weekend in this No Kings March, and it apparently appears that to some degree in response to that march, the president has torn down the historic East Wing after saying he wouldn't touch the building in order to build his gargantuan ballroom. He did it anyway. It's a quick teardown of the East Wing. Is this a response to the No Kings protest? Is it a slap in the face to Americans? This is their house.
I haven't seen anything that says it's a direct response to the No Kings protest. I think the late night hosts have commented pretty effectively on the tearing down of the East Wing. I will say, if you look at, it reminds me of gerrymandering, because you immediately have the Republicans and the president's defenders pointing to other historical examples and saying, well, look what President Truman, a Democrat, did to the White House when he gutted it in the 40s. So it's very similar in that you immediately have people pointing the finger back and saying, well, I can pick an example from, you know, 1963 where the other side did something that I think is similar. And again, the word spiral just keeps coming to mind.
It should be pointed out that the Truman gutting of the White House, the interior of the White House, was because it was structurally unsound.
Yeah, it was about something. Parts were in danger of collapse.
Exactly. So people turned out all over the country last weekend for these No Kings marches, and they were mostly peaceful, very few arrests around the country. Charlotte had, as I understand it, no arrests. How many people turned out in Charlotte? Do we know?
The estimates I saw were several thousand. I have not seen a more exact number than that. I believe, multiple thousands of people.
And there were marches also around Charlotte in Concord, Cornelius, Gaston County, Denver, Monroe, Waxhaw, and in Rock Hill. Were they reasonably sized turnouts there, or were they also peaceful?
Everything I saw around this region was peaceful. There were no arrests, again, in Charlotte. And I haven't seen any reports of arrests or disorder from the other protests, which drew hundreds to a small number of thousands of people around the region to each of them.
Tiffany Vargas is one of the people who turned out in Charlotte, and she told WFAE News why she and her family felt the need to be part of it.
The brute force that they're using is just unnecessary, especially considering they're using that brute force against everyone across the board. I feel like if you're really going after illegal immigrants, you would do it in the right way.
One of the organizers of the event here, Rachel Salo, told WFAE that she hoped participants would take away from that experience.
I hope people left today feeling supported, knowing where and how to plug in to doing more work, because we've got a lot to do, and uplifted by the community that we've tried to give opportunity to build.
Pundits commented positively on the number of people who turned out around the country for these marches, 7 million, but the U.S. population is 347.8 million, so 7 million is just about 2% of that. Does that make this march a success, really? Will it have any impact?
Well, we'll wait to see at the ballot box. Keep in mind that although the midterms are only a little more than a year away, they're still a year away. So I think it's really tough to say that anything that happens 13 months out from the midterms will have a direct impact.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on to other topics now. Mary, Charlotte City Council voted on Monday to postpone making their 7 appointments at the proposed Transit Authority Governing Board. Last week, Renee Perkins Johnson questioned the wisdom of spending time in advance of the referendum to vote on something that won't be necessary if voters say no to the sales tax. Is that why council ultimately decided to table this decision?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of discussion about that, as well as who will be eligible to serve on this board. And both of those issues tie back to, to the PAVE Act, the legislation that passed earlier this year, allowing the referendum to happen in the first place. The PAVE Act lays out very specifically who can serve on this new authority and when that new authority has to be in place. And if the referendum passes, that turnaround is very quick. And so that means that a lot of the municipalities, including the city of Charlotte, that will be appointing people, are sort of proactively already accepting applications, going through those applications, But you do have people sort of questioning the wisdom of that, again, like you said, given it's not a guarantee that it will happen, and ongoing discussions about whether the criteria for who can serve on the authority is inclusive enough, especially for people and communities that tend to be more reliant on transit, who a lot of local leaders say they really want to have a voice on this new authority.
People are voting on this referendum right now, and it will take sales tax up on most items by 1%, should we say yes to this. It will also raise billions of dollars over the course of 30 years for transit and road projects. There is no plan B if voters say no on this. So, and the Observer today issued their endorsement of this plan. They pointed out all of the problems and then said, vote yes, which puzzled me a little bit. But do we have any exit polling yet on how people are voting on this issue?
No, and we don't really have any entry polling, I think it's fair to say. These are historically, again, very low turnout elections, these mid-cycle elections, where you have maybe on a very busy one, 15% turnout. As of, you know, now, just looking as of this morning, there have been 6,642 ballots cast in the early voting. So, you know, we'll probably see somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 150,000 people vote if we follow historical precedent. So far, only 6,600 have.
The nonpartisan Charlotte Muslim Caucus plans to host a forum with elected officials about this tax referendum on Sunday at 4:15 at the Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte. And the founder of the caucus, Nasif Majid, told WFAE News the reason behind holding this forum.
Well, we know that there are some who are for and there are some who are, have their concerns and are kind of against. And so we wanted that balance. We know Suzanne has kind of some reservations, and we wanted that to be represented on the panel so that our viewers and those who participate can get a holistic view and make a proper decision.
He misspoke there. The Suzanne he's referring to is Susan Rodriguez McDowell, the only county commissioner to vote no on the referendum and who is vocal about her opposition to this 1% sales tax. Cats will benefit from the plan that this tax will support. And this referendum is coming at a time when Cats is under a lot of scrutiny because of the August murder on the Blue Line. And that's another reason the Muslim Caucus is holding this Sunday's forum. Again, Nasif Majid.
A lot of people were shook, and a lot of people are kind of afraid to go on and use transportation in certain areas. And so we want to be able to address people's concerns.
And as a measure of this concern, WCNC-TV reports this week that since that murder, ridership on the Blue Line has declined. By how much?
So in September of this year versus September of last year, there were 550,000 people who rode it last year, and now it is down 10% for the same time this year to 493,000 riders. But I think what is also kind of telling is that ridership was disproportionately lower at South End stations compared to a year ago. And that was especially the case on nights and weekends. And as we know, Arina Zarutska was killed on the light rail in South End at the East-West station. So I know it could be considered a leap to correlate the two. There could be other things that we just don't know from riders on how they're feeling. But we also know that we are on pace, according to documents that CNC got, to have one of the more dangerous years on our transit system just by the numbers, by the crime numbers on transit.
Last week, speaking of crime, CMPD announced their third quarter crime statistics. There was a 20% decline in violent crime, an 8% decrease in crime overall. Murders were down 24%. And then right after that, last weekend, we had four separate homicides in a 24-hour stretch. And several people died just yesterday afternoon, which we've already talked about. Despite this decreasing crime rate, there's a perception that crime is rampant, and perception is reality. It certainly is for Claire Covington, who lives in an uptown apartment and witnessed a crime with her family. Here's what she told Hunter Sines.
And we moved to Charlotte thinking it would be a great opportunity and a great place to raise children. And now we're definitely second guessing that.
What did she witness?
So she, there was a stabbing that happened outside of her apartment complex, and she was having friends over. She had her family there, two young daughters, and they go out to their balcony, and there's this guy bleeding out below after had just been stabbed. Medic is trying, of course, to help him. And she had just seen that victim while walking her dogs just about an hour before. She is one of many people in Uptown who we have heard from, and Eli spoke to this a little bit ago, of the perception and also the data that shows in Uptown, violent crime has started to go up here, and it's been concentrated to that Uptown area, and it's a problem for the city in general. So you can say that the numbers show 20% down on violent crime in the city, but I can tell you, people in Uptown who live in Uptown, who work in Uptown, who we are talking to crime after crime, don't feel that in that pocket of the area.
Eli.
Yeah. And, you know, a few weeks ago, there was that lunch hour shooting outside Brevard Court, you know, right across from Romare Bearden Park, that killed someone. You have these daytime shootings and stabbing, in places where there are thousands of people, those are going to have a bigger impact on public sentiment than a homicide that does not have that same geographic location. So it sounds kind of callous in some ways to say where it happens and when it happens matters because a life is lost either way. But that is simply the truth when you talk about perception.
Well, this woman that you spoke to, Hunter, Claire Covington, says she now carries a taser and pepper spray when she walks her dogs. And she says, quote, "We are allowing Uptown to be an unsafe place for everybody." Is that a common feeling that we are allowing this?
I think there is a frustration that the city isn't doing enough to stop it or to prevent it or to divert the troublemakers or the people who are making these decisions to go in a different route. Now, some would say, yeah, we're allowing it to happen inadvertently by not trying to prevent it. I will say the city has, we've heard from CMPD, it's probably been talked about on your show, that they have new units, they have new mechanisms that they are really trying to throw at Uptown. But it's also difficult when you're talking about an officer shortage and you have other neighborhoods that and other 911 calls that they're also having to respond to. So one thing is to try to throw more police, more presence, and there is power in presence. But I don't believe that residents believe that there is enough being done, even with those solutions that have been announced.
And as you mentioned, they have the CMPD has launched several initiatives to tamp down on crime, particularly in the Uptown area, in the aftermath of the stabbing on the Blue Line. It's not just guns, it's violence itself, and it's also a lack of mental health resources, a lack of courts, a lack of police, a lack of a lot of stuff, and it all boils down to money. We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and live stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo is here, our senior editor at WFAE News, Hunter Science, reporter for WSSC-TV, and Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Turning to a different type of crime than we've been talking about here of late, yesterday the FBI took a former Charlotte Hornets player into custody as part of a sports gambling investigation. Terry Rozier was arrested along with 30 other people yesterday around the country in two different stings, an NBA gambling operation and a poker operation that involved the mafia. These people in the NBA investigation are accused of using inside information to place unlawful wagers. And U.S. Attorney Joseph Nocella Jr. called this, quote, one of the most brazen is the word of the day, one of the most brazen sports corruption schemes since sports betting became widely legal in the United States. And one of the incidences, Hunter, or Eli, of this happening was while Terry Rozier was on the Hornets. He stepped out of the game because he threw the game So that the sports, I don't know how this all works, but he threw the game so that the sports people who betted against the Hornets would, or for the Hornets, whatever, would win. Is that correct?
So basically, and Eli can elaborate here too, but what I have read from the indictment is the allegation against him is that he faked an injury, but told, this is all according to the indictment, told the people who was in on all the bets. So you can bet on like individual athletes, how they're going to perform. Are they going to go over under certain stats? And so what he told them before the game is, hey, I'm going to fake this injury and get out of the game so that they would bet under on his individual stats and make thousands, if not a hundred thousands of dollars. And in the end, they argue that he would get a cut of that.
These are allegations. They are not proven yet. He's not guilty of anything yet. But nonetheless, one of you made a comment before we started. We were talking about this, that perhaps this is why the Hornets have been so bad.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly doesn't help to have your star player leaving the game in the first quarter with a fake injury to help people with their bets. So, I mean, yeah, it's interesting that this is tied so directly to individual athlete bets, you know, in the old style of betting where you might, you know, call up a bookie and say, yeah, I'm going to take the Hornets tonight. I mean, that's not what this is. This is really small atomized bets. This is people betting this specific player is going to underperform on this specific stat line. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, you can't do with an old school bookie or an old school Vegas sports book. This is all digital phone-based, you know, this is your FanDuel DraftKings stuff.
When he left the Hornets, he went to the Miami Heat. Do we know of any allegations while he was there?
So the indictment only contains allegations specific to him around this one game in 2023. That they go into a lot of detail with this one game, but they don't have other games detailed for him. Some of the other players and coaches involved in this, for example, Chauncey Billups, Hall of Famer, Portland Trailblazers coach, they name him in the poker bet indictment, but not in the NBA bet. But there is a conspirator in the NBA bet whose description, he's not named, but his description exactly matches Chauncey Billups. And they say that this person gave information about other NBA stars who are going to sit in other games. So, you know, it's pretty wide reaching. And I mean, basketball, one player can have a big impact. Like if a Panthers player, say, a Panthers offensive lineman wanted to throw a game, you're one of 11 people, you're rotating in and out. There's not that much you can do. Basketball, every player matters, and the stat betting is so granular that there's a huge incentive. If you want to, there's a huge incentive for a player to do something like this.
I can tell you're on FanDuel on a regular basis.
No, I'm not. Actually, I've never sports bet. I'm too terrified. And my wife is probably listening, and I'm really not doing that.
Well, that's because you work in public radio. You don't have any money to do that. This week, the Mecklenburg County Commission voted to contribute financially to the revitalization of the Excelsior Club. That's a landmark in West Charlotte that was a nightclub that brought some amazing talent to Charlotte back in the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. How much has the county decided to kick in, Mary?
Yeah, so the county voted this week to contribute $1.5 million to the project. The Charlotte City Council will vote on Monday on a similar investment, which will go towards the overall project, which is estimated to cost a little over $8 million.
Yeah, the city's talking about putting in $1.5 million as well, and we had District 6 Republican candidate for City Council, Krista Bakari, on this program this week. She's very much opposed to that action, saying there's much better use for city funds. On County Commission, both Elaine Powell and Susan Rodriguez McDowell voted against the move, too. Why?
Yeah, so Commissioner Rodriguez McDowell said she still had some lingering questions. She would have liked more time to talk to the development team behind the project and also had some concerns about the fact that it will be a for-profit business, not a nonprofit. And Commissioner Powell said she thinks it's a good project, but would have liked to have seen more foundations and non-governmental organizations stepping up to invest more.
There have been several attempts to resurrect the Excelsior Club over time. All of those attempts have failed. What gives our local council and commission confidence that they're going to kick in $3 million and it's going to work this time?
I think there's a lot of faith. We've heard from a lot of public officials in the team behind this, the development team behind it, the fact that it seems to be a little more concrete than some of the past plans, and also addressing some of the structural and literal sense issues with the building. It's a building that's really kind of fallen into disrepair since it closed in 2016, and this project will essentially replace it with a new building that will closely match building looks like.
And what makes this interesting is this is being positioned as as kind of saving an historic property, but they're going to demolish the current building and build a replica of it, essentially. And the total cost is $8.3 million, with the city and the county kicking in $3 million. Is this seen more as a vanity project or as a revitalization project, an economic development project? How's this being viewed?
I think a lot of people in the community do see it as a revitalization. A number of people spoke at the county commission meeting in favor on Tuesday, talking about the historical significance of this building, and beyond just the physical structure, you know, sort of what it represented, particularly for West Charlotte, for the African-American community, and really saying that, you know, while it will be a new building, it could really continue to embody that spirit and be a proactive place for the community, place that will have live music and food, but also host things like farmers markets, community forums, really sort of embodying the spirit of the original building, even though the original building isn't really safe to use anymore.
There was also news this week that Mecklenburg County's controversial Sheriff Gary McFadden has yet to decide whether or not he's going to run for re-election. He's been the subject of serious criticism over the last several years from former high-ranking employees who have publicly quit, citing the toxic work environment they allege the sheriff creates and operates under. Is that why he's on the fence about running again?
You know, I think that's part of it. He has also been publicly feuding with Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, ICE, about using the jail and detention center and how they are cooperating or not cooperating there. There's been a lot more political pressure on, you've seen from the General Assembly and people calling out what they call, quote unquote, woke sheriffs. So that's part of it. And then I think it's also worth mentioning that Cedric Dean and Tijuana Brown, who are both close allies of the sheriff, are embroiled in serious legal trouble now. Tijuana Brown, council member under indictment, Cedric Dean accused in a large Medicaid fraud case. And while there's no direct ties to the sheriff, he has not been accused or implicated in anything with them. These are really close allies of him who have publicly supported him, who he's gone on the campaign trail with before. And I think that's just an example of the kind of headache that he would face running for re-election again, is more questions about that.
Hunter.
I don't really offer opinions on this, but it's not an opinion, but it's when you cover Gary McFadden in the sheriff's department and you are familiar with, of course, the troubles, as we all are, but I wonder if not the sheriff, what would Gary McFadden do? We know he is a very personable person. He likes being in a leadership role. He likes taking on that type of work, that type of public job. And I just don't foresee him not running because of the work that he just really throws himself out there on. Even with all of the problems that the sheriff's office has dealt with, he also has the name recognition for many years now. And I know that some of his, some of the people running in the race already are known as well, but Gary's face is out there constantly for good or bad. And I have this gut feeling that I would be a little bit stunned if he doesn't throw his hat in the ring. I honestly think it could be a thing on timing as well. Announcing after this election, after the transit noise, after all of the stuff, and then getting throwing his hat before that deadline.
Mary, SNAP benefits, or what used to be called food stamps, are in jeopardy due to the government shutdown, but a new audit also cites two Charlotte area counties for delaying delivery of these food benefits to low-income families, even in normal times. What's going on in Mecklenburg and Stanley counties?
Yeah, so Mecklenburg and Stanley counties were listed in the bottom seven of all North Carolina counties in this recent audit from the state auditor's office on SNAP performance. Essentially, the federal government has a bunch of rules about how quickly a county has to process a SNAP application and start getting benefits to people, and also sets rules and regulations for sort of the how a very high percentage that states have to meet of meeting those requirements. And this audit found that North Carolina as a whole has dipped slightly below that federal standard, and specifically cited Mecklenburg and Stanley as among two of the worst counties for these delays. And the auditor's office essentially saying that when the applications aren't processed within the prescribed window, it takes longer for people to get their benefits, which can create serious issues for families in need.
And allegedly, both these counties have taken steps to improve that?
Yes, yeah. So reached out to both Mecklenburg and Stanley counties. They acknowledged the findings of the audit. They said they have been actively working to staff up the offices that handle and process these applications and working with the state health department to improve performance in order to get those delay numbers down.
Last week on this program, we spent time talking about confusion about the funding of teacher pay raises in Union County and how those raises had been postponed. Now, Union County School Board Finance Committee has proposed a $1,000 increase to the district's local teacher pay supplement. And that got this reaction from a 20-year Union County teacher who asked not to be named when WFAE spoke with her.
It's not enough, especially when they convinced teachers to stay for another year because they were getting us $2,000. They're going to lose a lot of teachers this year if we don't get enough money, because you can make so much more money in other areas that are very close by.
This $1,000 increase will come up for a vote, I think, on November the 6th. Is it all teachers that will get this, or might they get more? Is that all that teachers will get, or might they get more if the legislature does, in fact, take up the budget sometime before the end of the year, which does not look likely?
Yeah, so this is an across-the-board $1,000 increase for Union County teachers. It is all they would get unless the, you know, state budget resurrects, has a little Lazarus moment. But this is the local pay that Union County budgets to supplement the state budget for teacher pay. And initially, as the teacher there said, they were talking about $2,000, then $1,000. Then they delayed implementing the $1,000 increase because of uncertainty around the budget. So teachers have been waiting without any of that. And we saw a lot of discontent and big teacher sick out in Union County. It's ironic because this is all happening at a time when Union County is touting that their public schools have had the best test results in the state.
And we spoke to one of the parents who shared with WFAE what her son told her was happening during those teacher walkouts in the classroom.
He said that random subs are watching the classes and they have to stay in their first block classroom all day long and they can't leave. No recess, no cafeteria lunch, no electives. They're basically just sitting there not doing anything.
But she added the protest was a long time coming and that she was happy teachers were standing up for better pay. Is that the prevailing opinion out there?
I think right now, possibly, if that were to continue with sick outs and kids being, treated that way for a long time, you might see some shifts. I will say, as a working parent, it is really key that you can trust your teacher, your kids are being well cared for, and we tend to love our teachers.
On Tuesday, William Collier, the commissioner of Mecklenburg County Parks, told the county commission he needs more money to maintain the parks.
Past and current maintenance has been flat out underfunded. All types of maintenance, including routine and deferred, are not funded to adequate levels. And honestly, this is unacceptable.
The current budget, $7 million, is scheduled to drop to $4 million next year. He says they need $10 million, so there's a $6 million difference in what's going on here. How was this message received, Eli?
You know, there's really two sides. One is that we need more parks. We are underparked, for lack of a better term. The county's trying to build more, but at the same time, a lot of the older parks are you know, have facilities in disrepair. So I think there's a big tension between expanding the park system to meet the growing population and maintaining what we already have, which we are not doing a great job of.
So we have 30 seconds. The Panthers now have a winning record. They play somebody on Sunday, the Buffalo Bills on Sunday. They're now 4-3 on the season. We're in second place in the NFC South behind Tampa Bay, the first time since 2021 that we've been at 500. Game starts Sunday at 1 o'clock at the stadium. And Charlotte FC is in the playoffs on Tuesday against New York City at Bank of America Stadium. They have the home field advantage, but they'll be without their best player, Wilfried Zaha, who was red card in their match against the best team in the country that they beat, Philadelphia, last weekend. The series is said to have no clear favorite. I'm not going to ask you to make any predictions because we're out of time. Eli Portillo from WFAE, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Hunter Sines from WSOC. Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.